Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeback.com.
Welcome, Deep Divers, to another journey into the captivating, sometimes contradictory heart of American history. Today, we're not just rattling off facts. We're really asking a fundamental question about how we remember the figures who shaped history and how those memories, well, they get reevaluated, reimagined over time. You know, some leaders become these powerful symbols of strength, unity. Others are like lightning rods embodying these complex paradoxes, not just of their time, but ours too. Okay. Let's unpack this.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here is that, well, few figures in American history capture this tension quite like Andrew Jackson. He was the 7th U.S. president, right? 1829 to 1837. A formidable general, rose from, you know, frontier obscurity to national fame, and he's a central figure in what we call Jacksonian democracy. Mm-hmm. But his legacy is, it's just a profound paradox. He's phrased often as this advocate for working Americans, a champion of the people's will, a preserver of the Union. And yet at the same time, he's heavily criticized for, let's be frank, brutal racist policies, especially his actions against Native Americans. He really forces us to confront some uncomfortable truths in America's story.
Absolutely. And that's exactly our mission today. We're going deep, really deep into the many layers, often conflicting layers, of Jackson's life and presidency. Our goal isn't really to judge from, you know, our 21st century viewpoint. It's more about understanding the man, the turbulent era he lived in, and how his actions, for better or worse, still echo today. We've gathered a whole stack of articles researched for this deep dive, and the aim is to give you, our listener, a kind of shortcut, a clear, concise, genuinely well-informed way to grasp this incredibly complex, pivotal figure. So let's start where all good stories do, right at the beginning. To really get a sense of Andrew Jackson, you have to go way back. Back to his beginnings in the pretty brutal reality of the colonial Carolinas. Think 1767. It's a region already on edge, you know, simmering with the first whispers of revolution. That's the world he was born into, March 15th. Scots-Irish immigrant parents. And his early life wasn't just tough. It was this crucible of hardship, profound loss. It absolutely forged the man he became.
Indeed. His family history, it's quite telling. His parents, Andrew Jackson and Elizabeth Hutchinson, were Presbyterians. They'd emigrated from Ulster, Ireland, just a couple years earlier, 1765, looking for a new start. But tragically, his father died young, only 29, in February 1767, just 3 weeks before Andrew was even born. So Elizabeth was left a widow, raising three sons, including the infant Andrew, often relying on family, her sister, and brother-in-law. And his mother, Elizabeth, she had this strong, almost visceral hatred of the British, a feeling she explicitly passed on to her sons. That early anti-British sentiment turns out to be really significant. There's even, you know, some debate about his exact birthplace. Was it South Carolina, like he later claimed, or maybe just over the border in North Carolina at another uncle's place? Either way, it was the rugged frontier.
And his mother, despite things being tough, she had aspirations for him. She wanted him to be a minister. She actually invested what little money they had for him to be schooled by a local clergyman. So he was exposed to Greek and Latin, which might seem surprising given his later reputation, right? Fiery, impulsive. Yeah. But by all accounts, even then, he was just, quote, too strong-willed and hot-tempered for the ministry. You can almost picture him restless in that quiet classroom, already showing that intense, unyielding personality. How much do you think that early classical education mixed with that natural fire shaped his later talk, maybe even his political tactics?
Well, that's a fascinating question, because even if he ditched the ministry idea, those years of study, they probably gave him a certain discipline, a classical sense of rhetoric. You combine that with his raw, hot-tempered passion. Well, it became an incredibly potent mix in his public speaking, his political maneuvering later on. It's a crucial insight. These early experiences losing his father, his mother's deep anti-British feelings, they didn't just shape his fiery personality. They instilled this remarkable, almost unbreakable resilience. Those qualities absolutely defined his public life for decades, gave him that powerful populist edge.
And those early hardships, they weren't just personal. They were tangled up with the American Revolution that was sweeping through the colonies. Jackson and his two older brothers, Hugh and Robert, they actively served on the Patriot side. Hugh, the eldest, tragically died from heat exhaustion after the Battle of Stono Ferry in 79. A grim reminder of the war's reality. You see, the conflict hit the Jackson family hard, tearing at its already fragile core.
And it got even closer. It really embedded itself into Andrew's own memory, his own flesh. As anti-British feeling ramped up in the South, Andrew and Robert, still just teenagers, were captured by the British in April 1781. The British occupied a relative's home, and there's this vivid anecdote, almost legendary, speaks volumes about Jackson's character even then. A British officer, you know, typical arrogance, demanded Andrew polish his boots. Andrew even then flat out refused. Saw it as humiliating servitude. The officer, furious, slashed him with a sword, left permanent scars on his left hand and head. Robert refused too, got struck on the head. Then they were taken to a POW camp, suffered terribly malnourishment, smallpox, which was just rampant then.
And the tragedy, just heartbreakingly, continued even after they were released in a prisoner exchange. Robert died just 2 days after getting home, still suffering from smallpox and his injuries. And their mother, Elizabeth, in this final act of really heroic selflessness, she volunteered to nurse American POWs on British prison ships in Charleston. She contracted cholera herself and died soon after, leaving Andrew, just 14 years old, completely alone, an orphan, his entire immediate family wiped out by the war. It's almost impossible to imagine that psychological weight.
It's a defining moment, absolutely. Mm. This string of traumas had an undeniable, profound, long-term impact on his psyche, his political worldview. The sources say it increased his hatred for the values he associated with Britain, in particular aristocracy and political privilege. This is such a crucial early insight into how his common man persona formed. That deep suspicion of elites, the fierce belief in self-reliance and affinity for the underdog. You could almost see that 1876 lithograph, right? The brave boy the wax was. Mm-hmm. It shows that very moment, refusing to submit. It forged his identity. #... frontier lawyer, planter, and duels.
So the war's over, but the scars, visible and invisible, are still fresh. This young orphan now has to carve out a life. How does a boy forged in that kind of conflict end up studying law? Well, he worked briefly as a saddler, went back to school for a bit, even taught reading and writing. But by 1784, he heads to Salisbury, North Carolina to study law. Finishes his training, admitted to the bar in 87. This was the real start of his legal career, and it quickly pulled him towards the frontier.
That's right. His friend John McNary helped him get appointed as a prosecuting attorney in the Western District of North Carolina. That area would soon become Tennessee. And on that perilous journey to his new post, in Jonesboro, Jackson bought his first slave, a woman about his own age. This early involvement in slave ownership, it foreshadows a really complex, contradictory part of his life. He also fought his first duel there, accused another lawyer of impugning his character, though that one ended with both firing in the air, no injury. This early immersion, you see, in both the legal system and the morally tangled practice of slave ownership, it shows the complex world he was stepping into. Principles often bend for opportunity.
And he rose fast in rough and tumble Nashville, became a protege of William Blount, one of the most powerful men in the territory. Jackson dove headfirst into land speculation, formed a partnership dealing with claims, notably on Cherokee and Chickasaw territory, lands that hadn't exactly been given up voluntarily. He also became a slave trader, transporting enslaved people between Nashville and Natchez down the Mississippi along the dangerous Natchez Trace. He was absolutely a man of the frontier, involved in all its booming, often brutal businesses.
His personal life also saw, well, significant and controversial turns. While boarding at Rachel Stockley Donaldson's place, he met her daughter, Rachel Donaldson Robards. Rachel was in an unhappy marriage, separated by 1789. Jackson and Rachel got involved romantically, lived together as husband and wife, apparently thinking her divorce was finalized. But there was a big legal snag. Her first husband, Captain Lewis Robards, eventually petitioned for divorce, which was granted in 1793 based on Rachel's supposed infidelity. The couple then legally married in January 1794. But this controversy, it would hound them for years, fueled Jackson's bitterness towards political enemies. They bought their first plantation, Hunter's Hill, 640 acres, later moved to the Hermitage, which grew to 1,000 acres, became one of the state's biggest cotton plantations.
And as you mentioned, this growing wealth, the symbol of his success on the frontier, was undeniably, inextricably tied to exploiting human beings. He became this wealthy planter who, as the sources clearly state, profited off the forced labor of hundreds of enslaved African Americans. This wasn't some minor detail. It was absolutely central to his economic life.
The records show a pretty stark progression. In 1804, Jackson owned 9 enslaved African Americans. By 1820, over 100. By his death in 1845, over 150. Over his whole lifetime, he owned about 300 slaves in total. Now, theoretically, he subscribed to a paternalistic idea of slavery, you know, claiming it was morally okay if slaves were treated humanely, provided for. But the reality, far more brutal. He directed harsh punishment for slaves who disobeyed or ran away. There's this chilling 1804 ad to recover a runaway slave. Offers $10 extra for every 100 lashes any person will give him, up to 300 lashes. A number, as the sources note, that would likely have been fatal. This certainly complicates, or maybe just outright challenges, that common man image he later cultivated, wouldn't you say?
It absolutely does.
It's a crucial point, you know. Jackson's common man idea was powerful, but it was built on an economic system that profoundly exploited other people. It wasn't just a contradiction, it was foundational hypocrisy. Tied right into early American democracy, his own wealth. You can't really separate his populism from slavery.
Yeah, it paints a really complex, contradictory picture. And speaking of reputation, Jackson's tendency towards conflict, it hit a brutal peak in 1806, that infamous duel with Charles Dickinson. The argument had simmered for months. A classic frontier honor thing, accusations about horse racing bets, insults to Rachel. When they finally met, Dickinson fired first, hit Jackson square in the chest. The bullet lodged near his heart, stayed there his whole life. Now, most people would be done for. But Jackson, legend has it, just stood there, composed, returned fire, killed Dickinson. Talk about someone who refused to yield, even when shot. It wasn't just personal. It cemented his fearsome reputation. Didn't do wonders for his public image at the time, though.
No, it didn't. And then later that same year, Jackson gets involved in Aaron Burr's audacious, ultimately doomed plan. Burr wanted to conquer Spanish Florida, maybe drive the Spanish from Texas. Burr, who killed Hamilton in a duel, had actually stayed with the Jacksons at the Hermitage in 1805. Persuaded Jackson to join, promised land grants, rewards. Jackson, always eager for expansion, always ready to fight Spain, even told the Tennessee militia to get ready, agreed to provide boats, provisions. But his uncertainty grew as Burr's intentions got murkier. Jackson started warning people that some involved might be planning to break away from the U.S. When President Jefferson finally ordered Burr's arrest for treason, Jackson quickly shifted gears. Organized the militia to capture conspirators. Later implied Burr's co-conspirator, James Wilkinson, was the real traitor. Showed his quick tactical mind, even after being initially swayed.
So, after these early adventures, personal conflicts, the national stage calls again with the War of 1812, declared June 1812. Now, this war, while mainly driven by maritime stuff impressment, trade disputes, it presented this huge, almost irresistible opportunity for white settlers on the southern frontier. It was a chance to finally deal with Native American resistance, undermine British and Spanish support for tribes, and crucially, grab Florida from the weakening Spanish Empire, a real powder keg.
And Jackson, never one to miss a fight, immediately offered to raise volunteers. He wasn't called up right away, though. But after a string of demoralizing U.S. defeats up north, he enlisted over 2,000 men in January 1813, prepared to march them to New Orleans. But then, at Natchez, they were suddenly ordered to halt, then disband, by General Wilkinson, the same guy Jackson had accused of treason. Jackson, with characteristic stubbornness, fierce loyalty to his men, refused to just disband them in hostile territory. Instead, he personally led them on this incredibly tough 500-mile march back to Nashville. Harsh conditions shared their hardships. It was that feat of endurance, leadership, that earned him the nickname Hickory, later Old Hickory, for his toughness, his iron will, became synonymous with him.
His return to Nashville wasn't exactly quiet either, of course not, Andrew Jackson. He gets into this dramatic tavern brawl with the Benton brothers, Jesse and Thomas Hart Benton. It was over honor, a previous duel Jackson had officiated. No one died, but Jackson took a severe gunshot to the shoulder. Sources say it nearly killed him. He carried that bullet for years. Even with that severe injury, in immense pain, he wasn't down long, showed that incredible, almost superhuman resilience again.
His recovery was far from complete when Governor Willie Blount called out the militia in September 1813. This was after the horrifying Fort Mims massacre. The Red Sticks, a nativist faction of the Creek Confederacy allied with Tecumseh, had killed about 250 militiamen, civilians, women, children. Jackson, still nursing his wound, rode out to command. His objective: singular and ruthless, destroy the Red Sticks. He launched a scorched earth campaign, moved south with 2,500 militia, burned villages, destroyed supplies, even deliberately starved Red Stick women and children to break their will. This led to the Battle of Horseshoe Bend in March 1814. His combined force, including Cherokee, Choctaw, Loyal Creek allies, just massacred the Red Sticks. Almost all their warriors were killed. Estimates range from 800 to over 1,000. Nearly 300 women and children taken prisoner. A devastating, decisive victory.
And the consequences were huge, immediate. June 8th, Jackson's appointed a brigadier general in the U.S. Army, then quickly promoted to major general. With President Madison's okay, he imposed the Treaty of Fort Jackson. This wasn't a negotiation. It forced all Creek, even allies who fought alongside him, to surrender a staggering 23 million acres. Present-day Alabama and Georgia. This wasn't just punishment for the Red Sticks. It was an enormous opportunistic land grab. Benefited American expansion, cost all Creek dearly.
His focus then shifted sharply to the British and Spanish. He moved his forces to Mobile, accused the Spanish governor of West Florida of arming the Red Sticks, giving aid. When the governor responded by inviting British forces to Pensacola, clearly violating Spanish neutrality, Jackson saw his opening. He invaded Florida, defeated the Spanish and British at the Battle of Pensacola in November 1814, occupied the town, effectively ending the British threat in the Gulf. Soon after, he learned the British were planning a major climactic attack on New Orleans, the strategic gateway to the Mississippi, America's growing west.
Jackson evacuated Pensacola, reinforced Mobile, and raced his troops, often on horseback, to New Orleans. Arrived December 1, 1814, he immediately faced a loyalty challenge among the city's diverse Creole, Spanish inhabitants, so he instituted martial law. Controversial, but he thought it necessary for security. And in this remarkable display of pragmatism, he beefed up his forces, formed an unlikely alliance with Jean Lafitte's notorious smugglers, raised units of free African Americans, Creek, crucially, paid these non-white volunteers the same salary as white soldiers. This pragmatic, no-nonsense approach gathered him a diverse, maybe motley force of about 5,000 against the approaching British juggernaut.
The climactic battle, January 8, 1815. The British, with 10,000 battle-hardened veterans from the Napoleonic Wars, launched a frontal assault on Jackson's fortified position behind an earthwork. It was an absolute disaster for them. American troops, protected, firing accurately, just decimated the British. Over 2,000 casualties. Their commander, General Pakenham, killed the Americans. A mere 71 casualties. The difference was just astonishing.
That victory instantly shot Jackson into the stratosphere of national heroism. February 27, 1815, he gets the thanks of Congress, a Congressional Gold Medal, cemented his status. Savior of New Orleans, symbol of American resilience. What's absolutely fascinating here, though, is that the Treaty of Ghent, which officially ended the war, had actually been signed in Belgium back in December 1814, before the battle. News traveled slow. But Jackson's decisive win, quote, assured that the United States' control of the region between Mobile and New Orleans would not be effectively contested by European powers, end quote. This hard-won control also let the U.S. government just ignore treaty articles that would have returned those vast Creek lands taken earlier, solidified a pattern of displacing indigenous people.
Which raises an important question for you, the listener. How does this military triumph, making Jackson a revered hero, securing U.S. territory, simultaneously cement his image as this fierce protector of American interests, even as it comes at such a significant, often devastating cost to indigenous populations, and sometimes civil liberties, like with martial law? It's a tension that runs right through his whole career, his heroic defense of the nation often tangled up with the harsh realities of expansion and conquest.
After the War of 1812, you might think Jackson would, you know, relax a bit, bask in the glory, not a chance. He continued to play this absolutely central, often aggressive role in displacing Native Americans. He was appointed an Indian commissioner plenipotentiary, basically, full diplomatic powers. In that role, he negotiated and signed five treaties between 1816 and 1820. These treaties collectively handed over tens of millions of acres of land from the Creek, Choctaw, Cherokee, and Chickasaw to the U.S. His military success was quickly, ruthlessly turned into territorial expansion.
And his actions in Florida further cemented this pattern. He got involved in the First Seminole War starting December 1817. Even before that, July 1816, Jackson, without direct orders, ordered the destruction of the Negro Fort, a former British post on the Apalachicola River that became a haven for escaped slaves, indigenous people, seen as a threat to Southern slave property. Secretary of War John C. Calhoun then ordered Jackson to lead a campaign into Florida with full power to conduct the war as he may think best. Jackson seized the chance, invaded Florida, captured the Spanish Fort St. Marks, occupied Pensacola. By May 1818, he'd effectively crushed Seminole and Spanish resistance, asserted American dominance.
This bold invasion and what followed led to a major international incident, almost sparked another war. During the campaign, Jackson captured two British subjects, Robert Ambrister and Alexander Arbuthnot, suspected of working with the Seminoles, supplying them. After a brief, highly controversial court-martial, Jackson had both executed, sparked outrage in Britain, threatened to pull the two nations back into conflict. It was a bold, some would say reckless move, showed Jackson pushing diplomatic boundaries.
Despite the international outcry, a divided cabinet, Secretary of State John Quincy Adams staunchly defended Jackson. Adams, with remarkable foresight, believed Jackson's aggressive occupation would force Spain's hand. pushed them to sell Florida rather than risk more invasions. And he was right. It led to the Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819. Spain ceded Florida to the U.S. for $5 million. Jackson was later exonerated by a congressional investigation, further solidifying his image. Decisive, controversial, but got results. He then briefly served as Florida's first territorial governor in 1821. Was also key in the Jackson purchase of Chickasaw lands, leading directly to the founding of Memphis, Tennessee. More land for the nation. #hashtag the contentious election of 1824 and the corrupt bargain.
So after his military exploits, his time as governor, Jackson, this formidable war hero, turned his ambitions towards presidential politics. Around 1822, the political landscape was shifting dramatically. The Federalist Party had basically collapsed, ushered in the so-called era of good feelings, which ironically wasn't feeling so good as multiple contenders from the dominant Democratic-Republican Party fought for the nomination. It was wide open, ripe for a new kind of politician.
Jackson's entry was initially pretty strategic, meant as a stalking horse candidacy. Put forward not necessarily to win himself, but to draw votes from a rival specifically, William Crawford, a Washington insider, to keep Tennessee's votes away from him. But Jackson unexpectedly got huge popular support outside Tennessee. Fueled largely by the expansion of voting rights among white men after the War of 1812, he was seen as this popular war hero, an outsider promising reform, blamed powerful banks for the recent economic depression, spoke directly to this newly empowered electorate looking for a leader who understood them.
This surge in popular support also reflected a fundamental breakdown of the old way of nominating candidates, the congressional caucus system. The old guard was losing its grip. Power was shifting to state conventions, legislatures. Jackson, cleverly leveraging this, secured the Pennsylvania nomination, quickly positioned him as a leading national contender, not just regional, a sign of changing times in American democracy.
The election results. Unprecedented. Problematic. Jackson won a plurality of the most votes, but not a majority of both the popular and electoral votes. Got 99 electoral votes from the South, West, Mid-Atlantic. He was the only candidate to win states outside his home region, showing broad appeal. But no candidate won the electoral majority needed by the Constitution. This triggered a contingent election in the House of Representatives. Only the top three, Jackson, John Quincy Adams, William Crawford, were eligible. Henry Clay, Speaker of the House, eliminated from contention, now held immense power. He could essentially pick the winner.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, where the seeds of deep political hatred were sown. Clay, seeing a Jackson presidency as potentially disastrous for the economy, for his own political future, threw his considerable support behind John Quincy Adams. With Clay's crucial backing, Adams narrowly won in the House on the first ballot. Soon after, Adams appoints Clay as Secretary of State, the most important cabinet job, traditionally a stepping stone to the presidency. This immediately led Jackson's furious supporters to allege there was a corrupt bargain between Adams and Clay, claiming, with outrage, that Clay traded his influence for a cabinet post. That phrase, corrupt bargain, became their rallying cry.
This perceived betrayal was absolutely pivotal for Jackson. It didn't just cost him the presidency in 24, it deeply fueled his fight against what he saw as an elitist, anti-democratic, corrupt system. A system that, in his mind, had brazenly denied the clear will of the majority. This became a core tenet of his political philosophy, drove his relentless pursuit of the presidency later. It was a wound that never really healed. #hashtag the vicious election of 1828 and a personal tragedy.
The sting of that 1824 loss, especially the corrupt bargain, fundamentally changed Jackson's strategy and really the American political landscape. His supporters, just incandescent with rage, feeling betrayed, immediately started building a new political coalition, dedicated to undermining Adams, making sure he only served one term. This grassroots movement eventually became the Democratic Party in the 1830s, forever changing American two-party politics.
Adams's presidency, meanwhile, it struggled. He was seen as this intellectual elite, out of touch with the growing populist mood. His ambitious proposals consistently blocked by an increasingly hostile Congress. Jackson, in stark contrast, masterfully capitalized, championed the ordinary citizens, declared powerfully that the voice of the people must be heard. The Tariff of Abominations, that high protective tax Adams signed, further alienated Southern states, completely eroded his support there, set the perfect stage for Jackson's comeback.
And what a comeback. Jackson's victory in 1828 wasn't just a win, it was an overwhelming landslide, a true populist triumph. He got 56% of the popular vote, a staggering 68% of the electoral vote. This election wasn't just a change of presidents, it effectively ended the one-party era of good feelings. ushered in a new, more contentious age of two-party politics. Democrats versus, soon, the Whigs, signaled a profound shift in who held power, who was deemed worthy.
But this hard-won victory came at a deeply, tragically personal cost. The campaign leading up to 28 was characterized by just unprecedented levels of personal abuse that partisans flung at both candidates. Truly vicious, Jackson himself was slandered, called the son of an English prostitute and a mulatto. Accurately labeled a slave trader who trafficked in human flesh, details opponents used to paint him as immoral. There were pamphlets, the coffin handbills, accusing him of murdering 18 white men, including deserters. Alleged he stabbed a man in the back with his cane. Plus, outrageous, unfounded accusations, massacring Native American women and children at Horseshoe Bend, even eating bodies, threatening congressmen, all hurled against him.
But the cruelest, most devastating attacks were aimed at his beloved wife, Rachel. Both Jackson and Rachel were mercilessly accused of adultery for living together before her divorce was legally final. An issue, as we said, settled years ago. Rachel, a devout private woman, was under immense stress throughout the campaign, endured these relentless personal slanders as Jackson prepared for inauguration. Tragically, she fell ill, died of a stroke or heart attack just days after his decisive victory, literally collapsed under the weight of the attacks.
This tragedy haunted Jackson, hardened his already fierce resolve, shaped his view of political enemies. At her funeral, he uttered those heartbreaking, bitter words, "May God Almighty forgive her murderers, as I know she forgave them, I never can." That quote powerfully highlights the deeply personal nature of his political battles, how campaign venom could have real, devastating, irreversible consequences. It was a brutal character assassination with tragic results for Jackson and his loved ones, fueled his often ruthless tactics, his unyielding distrust of opponents.
Andrew Jackson arrived in Washington, D.C., a man deeply scarred by personal loss, fiercely committed to what he saw as the people's will. He was inaugurated March 4, 1829, seventh president. His predecessor, John Quincy Adams, embittered by defeat, the corrupt bargain accusations, famously refused to attend, a stark symbol of the political animosity gripping the Capitol. This inauguration was also a first in another way. First time the oath was taken on the east portico of the Capitol, not inside. A symbolic shift towards a more public, populist presidency heralded a new, turbulent era.
In his inaugural address delivered to this massive crowd, Jackson made several key promises. Protect state sovereignty, respect presidential limits, reform government, remove disloyal or incompetent appointees, and, perhaps surprisingly given his past, observe a fair policy toward Native Americans. A promise we'll definitely revisit, the public response. Overwhelmingly enthusiastic, a raw outpouring of popular feeling. Such was the fervor, the sheer size of the crowd. The White House was literally overrun by well-wishers. Streamed through the doors, caused minor damage, broke china, forced Jackson to escape through a window. This raucous scene quickly earned Jackson the memorable, if slightly critical, nickname King Mob.
That image, King Mob, it perfectly captures the populist energy, the democratic fervor that swept him into office, doesn't it? Symbolized a profound shift in power, away from the perceived elite, firmly towards the common man he championed. Chaotic, yes, but a powerful demonstration of a new kind of political engagement. #tag reforms in the spoil system. One of Jackson's immediate central priorities was tackling what he believed was rampant corruption, inefficiency in Adams's administration. He launched investigations into all executive departments, convinced the federal government was bloated, filled with political enemies. These inquiries did yield some significant findings. Revealed, for instance, $280,000, that's like $8.3 million today, stolen from the Treasury. His investigations also reportedly cut costs in the Navy Department by $1 million, roughly $29.5 million now. He pushed for stricter laws on embezzlement, tax evasion, sought better government accounting.
Alongside these anti-corruption moves, Jackson implemented a principle he called rotation in office. Now, before him, government jobs were often held for life. Created this kind of permanent bureaucracy Jackson felt was out of touch, maybe corrupt. Jackson argued that regularly cycling out these office holders and replacing them with loyal supporters from his own party would make government more responsive, accountable to the people. He even used the Tenure of Office Act of 1820, which let the president remove office holders to do just that. Removed about 10% of federal employees his first year, replaced them with loyal Democrats. While he argued this reduced corruption made office holders responsible to the popular will, he quickly got known by a more cynical name, the spoil system, essentially rewarding political loyalty with government jobs, consolidating his party's power.
This sounds incredibly familiar, doesn't it? That tension between real government reform, making bureaucracy responsive, and the political reward for loyalty to the victor belong the spoils. It's still a constant in government today, an old dance, always debated. While he was tackling corruption, political appointments, Jackson, surprisingly, got tangled up in this bizarre social scandal, consumed much of his first 2.5 years. Known as the Petticoat Affair or the Eaton Affair, it proved a major, politically damaging distraction.
The whole thing revolved around Margaret Eaton, the vibrant, outspoken wife of Jackson's Secretary of War, John Eaton. Margaret had a rather colorful past, a reputation for promiscuity. Openly accused of adultery accusations that ironically mirrored the slanders against Jackson's own wife, Rachel, during the 28 election. Many cabinet members' wives, led notably by Vice President Calhoun's wife, Floride, publicly ostracized Margaret, refused to socialize with the Eatons, excluded her from gatherings. This social split profoundly divided Jackson's entire cabinet, created this atmosphere of petty squabbling, personal animosity that paralyzed the administration.
Jackson, maybe more than anyone, understood the pain of such cruel accusations. Having seen Rachel suffer so terribly, ultimately die under their weight, he took Margaret Eaton's defense deeply personally, staunchly defended her, showed profound loyalty. But this loyalty had significant political fallout, led to this intractable standoff that ultimately resulted in the unprecedented dissolution of his entire cabinet in early 1831, except Postmaster General Barry, who'd supported Eaton. Astonishing how personal dynamics could torpedo political function.
This cabinet upheaval forced a complete restructuring of his advisory circle, led to the formation of the famous Kitchen Cabinet, an unofficial, varying group of trusted advisors. Influential figures like Martin Van Buren, Amos Kendall, Francis Preston Blair often met informally in the White House kitchen. Jackson increasingly turned to this informal group for candid advice, decision-making, bypassed his official, often squabbling cabinet. It just illustrates how profoundly personal dynamics, social perception, and the deep emotional scars of his own past could ripple out, impact political power at the highest levels.
Despite these internal fights, Jackson's presidency regrettably marked the beginning of a national policy of Native American removal. This was a period of intense, often violent strain between the expanding southern states and the 5 civilized tribes, Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, Seminoles, occupying rich farmland within state boundaries. These tribes, many had adopted significant aspects of white culture, written languages, farming, constitutional governments, even slavery, saw themselves as autonomous nations with sovereign rights to their ancestral lands, while the states increasingly asserted jurisdiction over them.
Jackson, a staunch advocate for states' rights when it suited him, strongly supported states extending jurisdiction over Native American lands. This position was directly challenged in the landmark 1832 Supreme Court case Worcester v. Georgia. Chief Justice John Marshall, in a powerful ruling, sided squarely with the Cherokee, declared Georgia's law asserting jurisdiction unconstitutional. Marshall said Georgia had no right to impose laws on Cherokee lands, recognizing the Cherokee Nation as a distinct political community. Which raises an important question for any republic, right? What happens when the executive branch just chooses to ignore a clear judicial ruling?
Right. And this is where that infamous, maybe apocryphal, quote, attributed to Jackson, captures his defiance perfectly. Well, John Marshall has made his decision, but now let him enforce it. Whether he said those exact words or not, Jackson made it clear he would not use the federal government to enforce the ruling of the Supreme Court. He simply refused to intervene for the Cherokee, effectively nullified the judicial branch's authority through inaction. A stark challenge to checks and balances.
Instead, Jackson used federal power not to protect tribes, but to enforce their separation from white settlers. In May 1830, Congress narrowly passed the Indian Removal Act. Jackson eagerly signed it. Ostensibly, the act granted the president the right to negotiate treaties to buy tribal lands in the east for lands west of the Mississippi, gave him broad discretion on how to use federal funds for this. Crucially, while presented as voluntary relocation, it was not implemented that way. Jackson's administration often got agreements through a coercive mix, bribes, fraud, and intimidation. Treaties were often signed by unrepresentative leaders, minority factions, not speaking for the whole nation, often under duress or for personal gain.
The forced removals that followed led to unimaginable suffering, loss. The Chickasaw, after personal negotiation with Jackson in 1830, agreed quickly, seeking to avoid conflict, but for others, brutal. Same year, Choctaw leaders signed the Treaty of Dancing Rabbit Creek. The vast majority didn't want it, but felt they had no choice. Their relocation was rife with corruption, theft, mismanagement by federal agents, led to great suffering, disease, starvation on the journey west. The Seminoles, after signing the Treaty of Payne's Landing in 1832 under coercion, mostly refused to move. Sparked the devastating 6-year Second Seminole War in 1835, bloody protracted conflict, thousands died. The Creek ceded land in the Treaty of Cassetta, but their private ownership wasn't protected. forced removal after the Creek War of 1836, another violent chapter, and the Cherokee. Despite leaders ceding land and the fraudulent Treaty of New Echota in 36, their tragic removal, the Trail of Tears, was ultimately enforced by Jackson's successor, Van Buren. Thousands died on that forced march in winter 1838.
Removal efforts also hit the Northwest, though Jackson failed with the powerful Iroquois. But peace treaties after the Black Hawk War, triggered by Meskwaki and Sauk trying to reclaim lands east of the Mississippi, further reduced their territory. In total, during his administration, Jackson negotiated about 70 treaties. Almost all Native Americans east of the Mississippi, south of Lake Michigan, around 70,000 people forcibly removed from ancestral homelands. The cost? Immense. Thousands of Native American lives lost because of the unsanitary conditions and epidemics arising from their dislocation, as well as their resistance to expulsion. The sources describe this act as ethnic cleansing, discuss it in the context of genocide. It's a stark example of how historical actions get reevaluated through a modern lens, challenges the narrative of Jackson as just a defender of democracy, forces us to confront the human cost of expansion, a stain on his legacy you just can't ignore.
It's a starkly contradictory outcome, isn't it? While this policy is a profound, undeniable stain, a moral crisis in U.S. history, the sources note it simultaneously contributed to his popularity with his constituency. It added over 170,000 square miles of land to the public domain, roughly five New York states, benefiting agricultural interests, small farmers, making land available cheap, fueled westward expansion, economic growth for white settlers. While Indian removal was unfolding, pushing federal power, Jackson faced another major domestic challenge, one that threatened the very fabric of the Union, the nullification crisis. Started with the Tariff of 1828, quickly dubbed the Tariff of Abominations, a highly protectionist tariff, safeguarding northern manufacturing from cheaper British imports. But it severely hurt southern cotton planters, raised prices of consumer goods, imported manufacturers, while cotton prices, their main export, had dropped significantly. The South felt exploited for the North's benefit.
Right after the tariff passed, this radical document, the South Carolina Exposition and Protest, was secretly sent to the Senate. Anonymously written by Jackson's own Vice President, John C. Calhoun, it asserted this radical interpretation of the Constitution, that it was just a compact of individual sovereign states. Yeah. Therefore, if the federal government exceeded its duties like enacting a harmful protective tariff, a state could declare this action unconstitutional and make the act null and void within the borders of that state. This concept was nullification. It threatened to unravel federal authority completely.
Jackson strongly suspected Calhoun was the author, vehemently opposed his interpretation, saw it as a direct threat to the Union. Jackson argued with his usual force that Congress had full authority for tariffs, that a dissenting state denied the will of the majority, which he thought paramount. The issue quickly became this profound, personal, ideological rivalry between the two men, once close political allies. You see the tension vividly in their famous toasts at Jefferson's birthday celebration, April 13, 1830. Jackson, raising his glass, declares, "Our federal union, it must be preserved," a direct challenge. Calhoun, right after, rebuts, "The Union, next to our liberty, the most dear."
Profound political theater.
The crisis escalated. The Tariff of 1832, a compromise reducing duties but still protectionist, failed to satisfy radicals in South Carolina. November 24, 1832, South Carolina defiantly passed its ordinance of nullification, declared both the 28 and 32 tariffs null and void within its borders, critically threatened to secede if the feds tried to use force to collect duties, open rebellion. Jackson's response. Swift, decisive, characteristic iron will. Immediately sent warships to Charleston Harbor. Clear show of force. Threatened to hang any man supporting nullification or secession. December 10th, issued a powerful proclamation.
Yeah.
Condemned nullification as contrary to the Constitution's letter and spirit. Explicitly rejected secession, called it treason. Declared South Carolina on the brink of insurrection and treason. In a related move, Calhoun, realizing his VP position was untenable, resigned December 28th, promptly elected to the Senate where he could continue his fight for states' rights.
To solidify federal authority, Jackson asked Congress for a force bill, authorizing military enforcement in South Carolina. Calhoun attacked it as despotism. But he and Henry Clay, the great compromiser, worked behind the scenes on a new compromise tariff, the Tariff of 1833. Jackson, seeing it as a way to end the confrontation without civil war, insisted the force bill pass before he'd signed the compromise. March 2, 1833, he signed both. Showed willingness to use force, but also openness to compromise. In a final, symbolic act of defiance, the South Carolina Convention rescinded nullification, but then immediately nullified the force bill itself. A petty act Jackson largely ignored. 2 months later, Jackson offered this chillingly prophetic reflection. The tariff was only the pretext, and disunion and Southern Confederacy the real object. The next pretext will be the Negro or slavery question.
This crisis really highlights Jackson's unwavering, almost singular commitment to preserving the Union at all costs, a principle Lincoln would echo profoundly later. Yet the root cause, Southern economic grievances, states' rights, and as Jackson predicted, the looming specter of slavery clearly foreshadows the deeper conflicts that would tear the nation apart 3 decades later. Shows how fragile the Union really was, even then. You really can't talk about Jackson's presidency without getting into his monumental, almost obsessive, battle against the Second Bank of the United States. Almost right after inauguration, Jackson started looking for ways to dismantle this powerful institution. Chartered by Madison in 1816 to stabilize the post-war of 1812 economy, it had grown into this behemoth with immense influence.
Jackson saw the bank as a kind of fourth branch of government run by an elite. A money power, he believed, controlled the labor and earnings of the real people, planters, farmers, mechanics, laborers, for its own profit. This feeling was deep-rooted in his own experience. A near bankruptcy in 1804 from credit-fueled land speculation had profoundly biased him against paper money, towards hard money, gold, and silver. He saw the bank as corrupt, aristocratic, serving only the wealthy few at the expense of the many, a direct contradiction to his populist ideals. In his first annual address, December 1829, Jackson openly challenged the bank, questioned its constitutionality, the soundness of his money. His supporters piled on, alleged it gave preferential loans to speculators, merchants over ordinary folks, used its money to bribe congressmen, the press, to keep its charter, even had alarming ties with foreign creditors, a full frontal assault framed as democracy versus privilege. Nicholas Biddle, the bank's highly capable, equally stubborn executive, launched his own fierce counter-campaign. Spent over $250,000, that's like $7.8 million today, printing pamphlets, lobbying Congress, hiring agents, giving loans to editors, congressmen, to boost the bank's image, push for recharter. Biddle's supporters, mostly conservative merchants, manufacturers, argued the bank was essential for national prosperity. Stable currency, regulated state banks, facilitated commerce.
This escalating fight peaked when Henry Clay, Jackson's perennial rival, leader of the National Republicans, convinced Biddle to seek reauthorization 2 years early in 1832. Clay thought it would trap Jackson in an election year. Veto the charter, lose pro-bank votes, sign it, alienate his anti-bank base. But after the recharter bill passed Congress, Jackson unequivocally vetoed it on July 10, 1832, arguing that the country should not surrender the will of the majority to the desires of the wealthy. A powerful populist statement. About the bank, sure, but also about American democracy itself.
So what does this all mean? For the presidency, for American economics, Jackson effectively framed the bank as this elitist institution working against ordinary Americans, a symbol of concentrated financial power overriding popular will. His veto wasn't just legislative. It was a declaration of war against what he saw as undemocratic money power. Solidified his image, people's champion against corrupt interests. It drastically expanded presidential power, positioning the executive as a direct representative of the people against Congress, powerful private institutions. #... the election of 1832 and the aftermath of the bank veto.
The 1832 presidential election became this huge referendum on Jackson's policies, especially that dramatic bank veto. This election also vividly showed the rapid development of real national political parties. Solidify the two-party system we know today. The New Democrats proudly nominated Jackson and Martin Van Buren.
Henry Clay, the National Republican candidate, expected Jackson's bold bank veto and the unpopular, in some places, Indian Removal Act to alienate lots of voters, especially in the East. But Clay's strategy largely failed. Jackson mobilized the Democratic Party's strong networks, his personal popularity. Crucially, losses from the bank veto in some commercial areas were offset by the act's popularity in the West, Northwest, where settlers wanted Native American lands. He also kept strong regional support. Northeast liked him for maintaining a stiff protective tariff. West-Southwest supported Indian removal, making public lands available. This political skill led to another landslide for Jackson. 55% popular vote, 219 electoral votes.
Interestingly, South Carolina, still bitter from nullification, refusing to support any national party, continued its defiance, cast its electoral votes for the relatively unknown John B. Floyd of Virginia, a clear protest vote.
Jackson saw his landslide as a clear mandate to continue his war on the bank, finish the job decisively. In 1833, he issued an executive order ending federal deposits in the bank, distributed them among state banks instead. This unilateral move was so controversial he had to replace two Treasury secretaries, Louis McLean, William J. Duane, who refused his orders, before Roger B. Taney, a loyalist, finally did it. Nicholas Biddle tried to retaliate, contracted credit, called in loans, hoping to cause an economic downturn, force a compromise. But it failed. The economy weathered it, and Biddle got blamed for the brief recession he engineered, eroded public trust in the bank further. Jackson's perceived overreach in this battle led to the formation of the Whig Party, opposed his expansion of executive power, famously called him King Andrew I. While the Senate censured Jackson in 1834 for his actions highly unusual, the House staunchly supported him, showed the deep, hostile political divisions. By July 1836, the bank held no federal deposits, its power thoroughly broken. #### paying off the national debt in the panic of 1837.
Amidst these intense economic battles, political fights, Jackson achieved something truly remarkable, unique in American history. January 1835, he paid off the national debt, the only time it's ever been fully accomplished. A truly significant, often overlooked financial milestone. Fiscal discipline.
This historic achievement came from a strategic mix. Tariff revenues, which were substantial, carefully managing federal funding of internal improvements, often vetoing projects he thought extravagant or unconstitutional, and critically, the sale of public lands. There was an unprecedented spike in land sales during his presidency, especially 34 to 36, profits 8 to 12 times higher than typical. During his time, a massive 63 million acres of public land, roughly Oklahoma size, were sold, much of it acquired through Native American removal. This revenue influx plus fiscal austerity made debt repayment possible. His political capital was so high at this point, his supporters in a Democrat-majority Senate even expunged his earlier censure in 1837, erased the rebuke, reflected his enduring power.
Yet despite this historic financial feat eliminating the national debt, Jackson's own economic policies soon, arguably directly, led to a severe financial depression, the Panic of 1837. It's a fascinating, almost cruel paradox, right? Achieve this milestone, then have policies contribute to a major crisis right after. What happened?
Indeed, it's critical to connect those dots. Jackson's own policies arguably contributed significantly to the panic. His 1833 executive order, transferring federal money from the National Bank to numerous pet banks, state banks friendly to the administration, led these Western banks to relax lending standards dramatically. Without the National Bank's regulation, excessive speculation took off, especially in land. The Indian Removal Act also played a role, making vast amounts of former Native American land available for purchase, fueling the boom. Then, two of Jackson's 1836 acts compounded it. The specie circular, mandating Western lands be bought only with specie gold and silver coin, not paper money. Meant to curb speculation, it instead caused a massive drain of specie from Eastern banks as settlers rushed for hard currency. This, plus the Deposit and Distribution Act of 1836, transferring surplus federal money from Eastern to Western state banks, further destabilized things, left Eastern banks unable to pay specie to creditors, especially the British, when they recalled loans. The resulting credit contraction led directly to a severe depression lasting until 1841. A powerful lesson in unintended consequences, even from well-intentioned policies, ## assassination attempts in the slavery question.
Jackson's fiery temper, decisive actions naturally made enemies. His presidency wasn't without personal threats. 1833, he was physically assaulted by Robert B. Randolph, a former naval officer he dismissed, struck him in the face. Jackson, ever the frontiersman, declined to press charges, shook it off.
More dramatically, January 1835, Jackson's leaving the Capitol after a funeral. Richard Lawrence, an unemployed house painter with delusions, aimed two pistols at him, close range. Miraculously, both misfired. Jackson, even at 67, frail, famously attacked Lawrence with his cane until others intervened, showed his indomitable spirit. Lawrence was later found not guilty by reason of insanity, but it marked a chilling first recorded attempt to assassinate a sitting president.
Beyond personal threats, Jackson also grappled with the deeply sensitive, increasingly divisive issue of slavery. Federal troops were used to crush Nat Turner's rebellion in Virginia, 1831, a brutal uprising that terrified the South. But Jackson ordered their withdrawal soon after, despite pleas for continued protection. Jackson understood slavery as divisive to the nation and maybe more pragmatically to his Democratic Party, saw its politicization as a direct threat to the Union he fought to preserve during nullification.
The issue escalated significantly in 1835. The American Anti-Slavery Society began a massive campaign, sending anti-slavery tracts through the mail into the South, trying to ignite abolitionist sentiment. Jackson reacted with fury, condemned the abolitionists as monsters and said they should die, argued with genuine conviction their activism would encourage sectionalism and destroy the Union, saw their actions as a direct threat to national unity, feared they'd provoke slave insurrections, lead to civil war. In response, he directed the Postal Service to only send tracts to subscribers whose names could then be made public, expose them to reprisal, violence. That December, he even asked Congress to prohibit circulating incendiary publications intended to instigate the slaves to insurrection in the South.
This really demonstrates Jackson's absolute prioritization of Union stability. Even at the profound cost of supporting pro-slavery measures, suppressing civil liberties, highlights a deep moral conflict of his era. Preserving the Union, seen as paramount, even over fundamental human rights, shows the compromises, paradoxes in his commitment to national unity. Hashtag foreign affairs and Texas annexation. Despite intense internal turmoil, personal battles, Jackson's administration also saw some notable, if less dramatic, foreign affairs successes. Negotiated the first trade agreement with an Asian country, Siam, 1833. Opened new commercial routes. His administration also successfully settled various spoliation claims, demands for compensation for U.S. ships, sailors unlawfully captured during the Napoleonic Wars with Denmark, Portugal, Spain, brought long overdue justice, financial redress.
The most significant foreign challenge, though, came from France. Initially refused to pay an agreed indemnity of 25 million francs, about $5 million, for spoliation claims from the Napoleonic era. Jackson, using characteristic bluster and tact, threatened reprisals against French property if payments weren't made, even ordered defense armaments. France bristled, temporarily put its Caribbean fleet on wartime footing, a diplomatic tightrope that could easily lead to war. Ultimately, both sides, seeing the stakes, avoided conflict. After some clever diplomacy where Jackson clarified he didn't intend to menace or insult the government of France, he eventually secured the $5 million payment. Showed his assertive diplomacy backed by force, but also pragmatic retreat when conflict loomed.
And then there was Texas, a deeply personal strategic issue for Jackson. He'd supported acquiring it since 1824, believed it a natural U.S. extension, tried to buy it from Mexico in 1829. During the Texas Revolution against Mexico, Jackson covertly allowed American settlers to get weapons, money from the U.S., unofficial support for Texan rebels.
While Jackson certainly wanted to annex the newly independent Republic of Texas after its victory at San Jacinto, April 1836, he was surprisingly hesitant. Unsure if Texas could maintain independence from Mexico, feared annexing a vast new slave state would further divide the Democrats, reignite explosive sectional tensions, a fight he'd just navigated during nullification, saw potential for a catastrophic split. So he prudently recognized the Republic of Texas on his very last day in office, March 3, 1837, left the contentious annexation question for his successor Van Buren, shows a more pragmatic, calculated Jackson. National expansion weighed against party stability, and more importantly, the fragile Union he swore to protect.
During his two terms, Andrew Jackson put six justices on the Supreme Court. While many were considered, well, undistinguished in their later impact, one appointment really stands out, and not necessarily in a good way.
Absolutely. January 1835, Jackson nominated Roger B. Taney. Primarily as a reward for Taney's loyal service during the Bank War, he was key in removing federal deposits. But the Senate, still largely hostile to Jackson's executive overreach, initially rejected him. But when Chief Justice John Marshall died later that year, Jackson nominated Taney again, this time as Chief Justice. Confirmed by the newly elected, more Democrat-friendly Senate, Taney would later be remembered infamously for his widely condemned decision in Dred Scott v. Sanford, a ruling that deeply worsened sectional tensions over slavery, pushed the nation closer to civil war. On his last day in office, Jackson also signed the Judiciary Act of 1837, notably created two new Supreme Court seats, reorganized federal circuits to accommodate westward expansion.
Jackson's presidency also saw two new states admitted, Arkansas in 1836, Michigan in 1837. Both, as expected, increased Democratic power in Congress. Their admission helped secure Van Buren's victory in 36, as new states tended to favor the party that brought them in. Strategic expansion also consolidated Democratic power, #, later life, political influence, and death. Andrew Jackson's presidency ended March 4, 1837. He retired to his beloved Hermitage in Nashville. But thinking his political influence ended there, big mistake. Even in retirement, plagued by ill health, he remained incredibly influential in national and state politics, a powerful elder statesman whose opinion still swayed elections policy.
He kept advocating for policies he believed in, notably supported an independent treasury system to counter inflation. Government holds its money in silver gold, not state banks. A legacy of his hard money views from the Bank War. Even campaigned vigorously for his protege, Van Buren, in 1840, despite Van Buren's unpopularity during the Depression. But William Henry Harrison, running a populist campaign strikingly like Jackson's own, defeated Van Buren. Jackson was briefly encouraged when Harrison's VP, John Tyler, unexpectedly vetoed two Whig bills for a new national bank. A small victory for Jacksonian ideals.
Jackson also continued his relentless, almost singular lobbying for Texas annexation, argued vehemently it was part of the Louisiana Purchase, deeply concerned the British could use it as a base to threaten the U.S. if it stayed independent, vital for American security, expansion.
His persistence paid off, though he didn't live to see the full consequences. President Tyler signed an annexation treaty in 1944, but it initially failed Senate ratification. Renewed concerns about expanding slavery. Disappointed by Van Buren's opposition to immediate annexation, Jackson strategically convinced fellow Tennessean James K. Polk to run, secured Polk's nomination over Van Buren. Polk, a loyal Jackson protege, won against Henry Clay, making annexation central. Meanwhile, a Senate bill to annex Texas finally passed, signed March 1, 1845, just months before Jackson's death, a final complex victory for his expansionist vision.
Andrew Jackson died June 8, 1845. Age 78, surrounded by his adopted family, loyal friends, and his enslaved people at the Hermitage. The end to a long, tumultuous, deeply impactful life.
His final recorded words amidst this diverse group are quite poignant. Reveal another layer. Do not cry. I hope to meet you all in heaven. Yes, all in heaven, white and black. These words, given his complex, often brutal history with slavery, Native Americans, add another layer of profound complexity. To his personal beliefs, his relationship with those he enslaved, the deep, unresolved contradictions he embodied till his very last breath.
In his personal life, Jackson and Rachel had no biological children, but they built this robust, loving family in other ways. Adopted Andrew Jackson Jr., Rachel's nephew, acted as guardians for numerous nieces, nephews, friends, orphan children. Created a large extended family at the Hermitage, clearly valued family loyalty fiercely.
During his widower presidency, this unique situation arose. Two women, both relatives, acted simultaneously as unofficial first ladies. His niece, Emily Donaldson, served as hostess, alongside her husband, Andrew Jackson Donaldson, Jackson's private secretary. Emily's relationship with Jackson became tragically estranged for over a year. During the petticoat affair, she sided with the wives ostracizing Margaret Eaton, but they eventually reconciled before Emily's untimely death in 1836. Later, Sarah York Jackson, his daughter-in-law, became co-hostess in 1834, took over all duties after Emily's passing, speaks to the office's unique demands, Jackson's personal loyalties.
Jackson also had this truly notorious reputation for being short-tempered and violent, a quality that genuinely terrified his opponents. Known for taking things incredibly personally, turning political disagreements into personal vendettas, fueled many famous battles, feuds.
While his temper was indeed formidable, often displayed, sources also say he could use it strategically, deploy it as a political weapon, yet paradoxically, often remained calm in times of difficulty, made decisions deliberatively during crises. However, if someone crossed him or he perceived betrayal, he often became obsessed with crushing them. A personal trait defining his long feuds, a telling anecdote capturing this duality, his famous regret on his last day as president that he had not shot Henry Clay or hanged John C. Calhoun, his two bitterest rivals. Yet, alongside this animosity, he also had unquestioning loyalty for friends, demanded the same fierce devotion back, a man of intense, deep-seated passions, a real Jekyll and Hyde of political temperament.
This fascinating mix, self-confidence, perseverance, fierce reputation, surprising tactical calm, often led opponents to tragically underestimate his true political shrewdness. He was far from just a simple brawler, a master strategist beneath the fire, an incredibly astute politician. And a final personal detail, again speaking to his complexity. Officially joined the First Presbyterian Church of Nashville in 1838, after his presidency. Stated he waited until retirement to avoid accusations of doing it for political reasons. Suggests a genuine, if private, spiritual conviction.
This deep dive into his personal character, profound losses, fiery passions, calculated shrewdness truly helps explain the intense devotion he inspired and the equally fierce opposition, terror he struck into enemies. A figure of unwavering, often contradictory conviction, for better or worse. These personal traits inextricably linked to his public actions, legacy. #Hashtag the enduring, polarizing legacy.
Andrew Jackson's legacy is, without a doubt, one of the most controversial and polarizing in American history. It's a legacy that hasn't stayed static, shifted dramatically over time, reflects evolving values, new evidence, changing political interpretations. He remains a powerful, often uncomfortable mirror to America's past and present.
Contemporaries themselves held wildly conflicting views, showcased his immediate divisiveness. Alexis de Tocqueville, the French observer, saw him as a spokesperson of the majority and their passions, a true representative of popular democracy. He's been called a frontiersman, embodying rugged independence, a complex, slave-owning member of the Southern gentry, a populist promoting faith in the wisdom of the ordinary citizen.
simultaneously seen as a statesman advancing democracy, fiercely upholding constitutionalism by preserving the Union, and an autocratic demagogue who crushed political opposition and trampled the law with executive overreach, defiance of the Supreme Court. This vast range of views underscores his multifaceted nature.
And these interpretations kept evolving through the 20th century. 1920s, Jackson's rise linked to the common man, rejecting elites. Then, 1945, Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s hugely influential book, The Age of Jackson, redefined him through FDR's New Deal lens, portrayed him as a defender of the exploited and downtrodden, fighting for social economic equality, gave him this progressive sheen for decades.
Later presidents kept invoking Jackson's legacy for their own ends, highlights his enduring symbolic power. Abraham Lincoln, facing the greatest threat to the Union, referenced Jackson's ideas' unwavering commitment to unity during nullification as he prepared for civil war. Franklin D. Roosevelt strategically used Jackson's populist image to redefine the Democratic Party as the party of the common person. More recently, Donald Trump explicitly used Jackson's legacy to present himself as the president of the common man, praised him for saving the country from rising aristocracy, protecting workers with tariffs, drawing direct parallels to his own platform.
In modern times, the reassessment's been even more stark challenging. The Obama administration announced plans, 2016, remove Jackson's portrait from the $20 bill front, replace with Harriet Tubman plan, resumed by Biden, symbolically acknowledging his past profound moral contradictions. The Indian Removal Act, as we discussed, now widely described not just as policy, but ethnic cleansing discussed in the context of genocide. Intense debate on its devastating role destroying Native American cultures. Lives. We've even seen white supremacist groups bizarrely use his image, trying to claim his legacy. And in 2020, anti-racist protesters in D.C. tried pulling down his statue. Reflects intense contemporary anger over his actions.
Scholarly rankings of presidents clearly reflect this contradictory legacy, historians' evolving moral compass. Historically, Jackson often rated above average, solid figure. But his reputation began declining significantly in the 1960s, as civil rights movements highlighted historical injustices. C-SPAN polls show a drop, 13th in 2009 to 22nd in 2021. Similarly, the Presidential Greatness Project ranked him 9th in 2014, falling to 21st in 2024. Interestingly, they also ranked him the second most polarizing president after Donald Trump, highlights how sharply divided opinions remain today, directly links his historical controversies to contemporary political divisions. This just demonstrates history isn't some fixed story. Our understanding of figures like Jackson continually evolves as our societal values, perspective shift, constantly challenges us to re-examine the narratives we inherit.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the remarkable, often unsettling, undeniably complex life of Andrew Jackson. We've explored his undeniable impact on American democracy, from military achievements forging a hero, to fierce populism resonating with the common man, his profound role shaping the presidency itself. But we've also confronted the profound contradictions. The fierce champion of the common man, who is also the architect of ethnic cleansing. The unyielding preserver of the Union, who presided over deep moral conflicts, tragically enabled slavery's expansion.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Jackson truly stands as a mirror to America's own complexities. He embodies both some cherished ideals, popular democracy, self-reliance, national unity, and some deeply troubling actions, particularly systemic oppression of Native Americans, perpetuation of slavery. Understanding him isn't about simplification, choosing one narrative. It's about engaging with the profound, sometimes uncomfortable nuance, recognizing American history as a tapestry woven with threads of both glory and tragedy.
So as you reflect on Jackson's shifting reputation, the ever-changing nature of historical judgment, let me leave you with a final provocative thought. Given how radically our view of figures like Jackson can change, what qualities in a leader do you believe truly stand the test of time and moral scrutiny, and which are inevitably reevaluated, recontextualized by future generations? This is a story that invites us to constantly question, re-examine the narratives we inherit, and to truly understand the costs and the triumphs of the American experiment.